Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 78 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, the biographer Nicholas Murray speaks with George Miller about literary biography and his acclaimed life of Huxley.
My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest in this programme is biographer, novelist and poet Nicholas Murray. Nick is the author of several literary biographies, including Lives of Franz Kafka, Aldous Huxley, Bruce Chatwin, Andrew Marvell and Matthew Arnold. And it's literary biography, and in particular his acclaimed life of novelist and essayist Aldous Huxley, that forms the core of this first part of our two-part conversation. In the second part, we talk about Nick's career as a poet and his book on the British poets of the First World War. Born in Liverpool, Nick now divides his time between Wales and London. This interview was recorded in his flat in Bloomsbury. I began by asking him to tell me about his origins in Liverpool.
Well, I was born, my family had been in Liverpool for as long as anyone can remember, and I wrote a book called So Spirited a Town, Visions and Versions of Liverpool, which was the way in which Liverpool had been represented by writers, and the writers who had tried to describe it and respond to it. Yes, it's the sort of place that you don't grow up indifferent to, and I think it probably has marked me. And I was educated at Liverpool University as well, as local schools. Then I came to London shortly after I got married in my early 20s. Then in about mid-1980s, we moved out of London and went to live in Wales in the Welsh Borders. But I also have a little toehold in London now, and to some degree I'm a long-distance commuter.
And as you say, we're sitting in London, we're in Bloomsbury at the moment, and Bloomsbury is an area which crops up again and again in projects that you've worked on.
Very much so, yes. I mean, in my biography of Aldous Huxley, although you won't think of him as a central member of the Bloomsbury group, he was peripheral to it. He knew Lady Ottilien Morrell and the rest of the crew. And because I've spent a lot of time in this little tiny studio flat in Bloomsbury, I've written a book called Real Bloomsbury, which is a kind of very personal guide to the patch, and it's endlessly fascinating. And of course, from a writer's point of view, Bloomsbury is very much is full of interest, writerly connections at every turn.
Take me back a bit and tell me how you became a writer, and when you set out on that path, what sort of writer did you think you wanted to be?
Well, from one point of view, for as long as I can remember, I've enjoyed writing, you know, at school and as a child, I used to make up, you know, mock newspapers. And I think I originally probably wanted to be a journalist. And in fact, I did become a journalist. So technically, that's how my scribbling career began. Although I was writing poetry very early, and poetry has been a constant throughout my career. But of course, you don't make a living out of poetry. So it was the non-fiction books that have enabled me more or less to do that. But I've always wanted to write. I've always enjoyed writing. I've always found it something that comes to me very naturally. The phenomenon known as writer's block, which one reads so much about, has never touched me at all. In fact, my problem is trying to restrain myself. I think you tend in life, don't you, to gravitate towards those things which you find you can do well.
Tell me about biography, because, as you say, you've been active in a number of genres. You've written fiction, you've written poetry, you've written historical books. But biography looms large in the list of your publications.
Literary biography in particular is what I've specialised in. It's an interesting genre because it's had its ups and downs. Unfortunately, at the moment, it's in something of a trough where even distinguished exponents of the genre, like Michael Holroyd, are struggling. Publishers have fallen out of love with literary biography. It was when I began in the 1990s, it was still a very, very popular genre. You would walk into a high street bookshop and the first thing you'd see would be a table with the latest literary biography displayed. Now, you have to go and ferret in the back of the shop to find the latest biography. But I enjoyed doing it because I'm simply curious. I like knowing about writers, about how they live their lives, and I just find it an enjoyable genre to work in. I like doing the research, and for example, my biography of Aldous Huxley involved a lot of very interesting travel. I went to the places that he went to. I went to Italy, I went to America, I went to the Mojave Desert, I went to Hampstead. I just went everywhere. And so that's rather fun.
And when you set out on a journey, a metaphorical journey as well as a literal one, do you have particular things that you want to get to the bottom of, particular questions in your mind about the nature of the subject?
Yes, I think there has been a choice. I've been lucky enough with my biographies to be able to, as it were, to sell my idea. In other words, there was only one book, which I'll mention in a second, where the idea was put to me and I, as it were, responded positively to it. So there has been a very definite sense of my making a choice. And the Huxley biography was followed an earlier biography about Matthew Arnold. Huxley, in fact, was the great nephew of Matthew Arnold. And his mother, Huxley's mother, was the daughter of Matthew's brother, Tom Arnold. And his aunt was Mary Augusta Ward, the novelist known as Mrs. Humphrey Ward, who had a character in one of her novels with a very, very strange name, Christian name, Aldous, and that's where it came from. I've never come across another human being called Aldous in my life. That was on his mother's side. On his father's side, he was descended from the great Victorian scientist Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, as he was known. So these two powerful strands in 19th century thought, science and poetry, came together. And I wrote the biography of Matthew Arnold because I was interested in, I suppose I'm interested in writers who engage with society, culture, politics, and I felt that Huxley was very much in that tradition. I'm not interested in writers who live in a cocoon somewhere. I like writers who get their hands dirty with life and society. And that has guided me, I think, in my choice of subjects.
Does it come into the decision-making when you're thinking about biography, whether there's been a biography before, whether someone else has already written the life, or is that in creative terms? I mean, obviously in commercial terms, it may have a bearing, but in sort of creative terms, is that neither here nor there?
It's very interesting to do the first life of somebody. In a sense, that's what happened with my little book on Bruce Chapman, which was a kind of introductory book to his life and work. And it was commissioned at about the same time as Nicholas Shakespeare's Authorized Life. I produced mine quite quickly. He took rather a long time to produce his, which gave a good life to that little book, and it was reprinted and was quite successful, and because at the time Chapman was very much flavour of the month. With Huxley, I wasn't the first, but there hadn't been a full biography for 30 years. There was a lot more new material, and I was enormously fortunate that the first biographer of Huxley, Sybil Bedford, was still alive. She was in her 90s, sharp as a razor. And I went to see her, and I saw her several times, and she was enormously helpful to me. And I felt that there was a kind of continuity, because she was not merely his biographer. She knew him. She spent a lot of time with Huxley and his wife. So that I felt that somehow that one was engaged with a slightly more living topic than writing about a Victorian. And I was able to speak to his second wife, Laura, in Hollywood, and his son, Matthew. All these people now are dead. So I just caught them, as it were.
I suppose there is a period, isn't there, where you have to, otherwise the task of the biographer becomes purely archival.
Indeed. I was very amused when I was writing my biography of Matthew Arnold. I arrived at Balliol College, Oxford, and the librarian greeted me with the question, "Is this the authorised biography?" And I felt, well, dear me, Arnold had been dead for so long. I don't think that was a question. But I think, I think there's an issue about authorised and unauthorised biographies. I actually teach biography writing in the creative writing department of the City Lit. And in fact, yesterday, one of my classes, a student was asking me, well, you know, what does it mean, authorised and unauthorised? And in some ways, it has a slightly uncomfortable ring, as if it's slightly a sort of Stalinist idea that this is the authorised life of somebody. Or, by contrast, that the unauthorised life is some sort of vaguely illicit activity. To me, one just writes the life. Authorized simply means that you've usually that you've got some cooperation from the estate. I like to write biographies that are about subjects that I'm keen on, interested in, feel positively about. I don't think I could spend 3 years of my life writing a biography of somebody I loathed simply in order to do a hatchet job. To me, that would be a waste of time.
I guess, though, that your relationship with your subject goes through evolution while you're working on it. At some points, maybe you feel warmer towards them than others, or at some points you have a sort of breakthrough and you understand something about them you didn't at the start.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, I've never fallen out of love with the subject. In a sense, the more you know about people, the more you become involved with them, the more you're more likely to find them interesting, the more time you spent with them. Though I could well imagine the exact opposite happening, but it hasn't happened to me. I mean, like anybody else, when you set out, you have preconceptions, and sometimes you have to revise these radically. For example, Matthew Arnold, in some quarters, is still a byword because he wrote about culture and he defined it famously the best that has been thought and said in the world. People immediately assumed that he was some kind of cultural elitist looking down his nose at the masses, and nothing could be further from the truth. And I always say to people, go away and read his two essays, Equality and Democracy, and then come back and tell me he was an elitist. You know, he wanted culture. He believed in culture, but he wanted it disseminated and spread to everyone. He wanted everyone to be at the feast. And I think this is a crucial fact about him and a crucial misunderstanding about him by many people who haven't been familiar with him. And I think all writers do this. They carry around with them a sort of ready-made account of themselves. And it's the job of the biographer to dissolve that and tell us what they were really like.
I read an interesting post on your blog recently where you were writing about biography. And if I were to summarize it, I think you were saying in essence, there are the questions about what can we know? What should we know? In other words, what have we a right to know? And why does it matter in any case? And are those questions that you have to have a settled answer to? Are those things you're perpetually kind of interrogating and thinking about?
I think that's very true. I think the post you're referring to was John Cornwell's biography of John Henry Newman, who Matthew Arnold met. He was a contemporary. And there's a whole thing which Cornwell is a very intelligent and sensitive biographer who deals with the question of whether or not Newman was gay or not, because he had a very close and affectionate relationship with another priest and insisted that they were buried in the same grave. My very old friend Peter Tetchell, the gay rights campaigner, is convinced that the Catholic Church has been practicing some kind of cover-up to deny Newman's sexuality. I think Cornwell is much more subtle and says, we simply don't know. But the biography, in your Olympian fashion, you come along and try to judge the person. And again, something I say to my biography writing class, I say, you know, you're not there to be on a sort of moral high ground judging everybody. You're just trying to make an honest assessment of what happened to them, what they were like. It's very easy as a biographer to slip into this rather unctuous tone of sort of ticking off your subject. there was something wrong with their sexuality, or they were racist, or they were a little bit imperialist. And I think you have to sort of realize that they were fallible human beings like you are.
Is the kind of Sunday supplement appetite to have the, you know, the 3,000 word extract of the 150,000 word biography which reveals that so-and-so was gay, or so-and-so slept with such-and-such, or so-and-so was a closet fascist or whatever?
Yes, indeed. Although I have to say, I wish the Sunday papers would take 3,000 words off.
But if they did, they would. That's what they want. They want those kind of certainties, and they want this sort of titillation.
Indeed, yes. In other words, the new biography reveals that Winston Churchill was a crypto-fascist or whatever. Yes, I mean, this is what people are sort of looking for. It's sometimes suggested that biographers come under some kind of pressure from publishers. In other words, they say, come on, spice it up a bit. Well, they don't. I mean, my book, five of my books have been published by Little Brown UK, which is a mainstream commercial publisher. It's not a university press. It's interested in selling books. It's a wholly commercial outfit. And they have never once tried to do anything like that. The possible exception of the title, the subtitle of my book about the poets of the First World War, which was originally the British poet. It's called The Red Sweet Wine of Youth, the line taken from a famous sonnet of Rupert Brooke. The subtitle was The British Poets of the First World War. I lost the battle to have that changed to The Brief and Brave Lives of the War Poets, and I pointed out that some of these people, like Edmund Blunden, David Jones, Siegfried Sassoon, lived until they were 80 or 90, until I lost the battle. But that's the only example I can think of where some sort of marketing or commercial pressure has been directly applied.
It's not just sexual histories which come under that sort of scrutiny, is it? I mean, you referred to the case of Arnold and sort of slightly patrician attitudes to the masses being ascribed to him. And that's the same in the case of Huxley. And also you have to deal with the problems of, you know, there have been charges of anti-Semitism, there have been charges of sympathy for eugenics and so on. Mm. How conscious are you of having to deal with those things as you write?
Oh, well, I think it's very, very important to deal with them, directly and unflinchingly, and not try and excuse them. I think in the case of the anti-Semitism that was seen to permeate British society, even in the early 20th century, nobody escapes the charge. You know, T.S. Eliot and Huxley. I mean, Huxley had Jewish friends, and I think it was, there might be, if one looks hard enough, there'll be the odd injudicious remark, but I don't think it's a serious charge. I did find myself slightly coming to his defense on the eugenics question, because although he did look into it, as so many people did at that time, often coming from the progressive camp, so to speak, because they thought it might have been one way of trying to make the world a better place. Having investigated it, he backed off, unlike his brother, Sir Julian Huxley. So I think it's rather unfair, and perhaps the most prominent of Huxley's critics is the John Carey in his famous book, The Intellectuals and the Masses, which I think is a gross misrepresentation of Huxley, and I've taken one or two opportunities to say so.
For someone who perhaps only knows Brave New World, or perhaps knows no more than the title of that, can you perhaps just give a little flavour of the man? What sort of man was he, and what sort of preoccupations animated him?
Well, I think for the start, he was probably a rather difficult man to get to know personally. I don't mean by that he was difficult. I meant he was very, very cerebral. He was very, very tall. And Christopher Isherwood made a very funny comment about the fact that there's almost a category difference between people who are very tall and, as Isherwood was, rather shorter.
Well, when you see pictures of him and his wife, there's a very substantial differential in height, isn't there?
Oh, there is. And in fact, there is a wonderful photograph, which I think is in the book, of him, his wife, and his son. And it's like that Monty Python sketch of, is it Monty Python? One of those comedy sketches, anyway. So he fell in love with, in the 30s, an article, a man who produced a series of sort of categorizations of human types. And borrowing...
When you say fell in love with, you mean intellectually, became attracted to it.
Yes. Borrowing that terminology, Huxley called himself a cerebrotonic, which we can translate into plain English, egghead. He was a very, very intellectual person, and could, for that reason, perhaps seem a little bit cold and remote. There's a story told about him when he was living in California. He looked out of the window and he saw one of his neighbours, a young man, spending hours polishing his sports car. And he looked at this as if it was about as intelligible to him as some ritual of the Inuit. You know, he just couldn't... Modern consumer society had no interest for him. He was a man of books and ideas. So, although in many ways people think of him perhaps, because of Brave New World, as an exemplar of modernity, actually he, in many ways, there was an old-fashioned streak to him. And I went to interview his second wife, Laura Huxley, in the house in Hollywood, the house in which he died. And we sat on the veranda at the back and we could see the white Hollywood letters on the side of the hill. And she told me that one of her neighbours had spotted Huxley going out to put out the rubbish. And she watched him walk down the drive, holding this bag of rubbish and place it in the bin with the elegance of a court chamberlain in his tweed jacket. And so he remained, in spite of all that time in America, he remained a very, very English figure.
Well, he was born in the Victorian era from a great Victorian family. He went to Eton and he went to Oxford, and he was a mature man by the time he settled in America. So I suppose it's not surprising that when he landed in Hollywood, so to speak, it was an alien environment, really, wasn't it? And contained some of the things which really his work warns against.
Yes. I mean, in a sense, you could say that he might have taken forward the work of his great uncle, Matthew Arnold, in the sense that he was a critic of many aspects of commercial culture. And this is why people like John Kerry got him so wrong, because they misinterpreted that as contempt for the masses and their simple pleasures. In fact, it was because he didn't have contempt for the masses that he wanted them, like Arnold did, to enjoy the fruits, the riches that he knew he was experiencing. And he felt that this is what all Brave New World is all about. It's all about mindless consumerism taking over people's minds, advertising jingles, the whole concept in that book of Fordism, the idea that human beings in mass commercial culture are reduced to the status of cars rolling off a production line. He wanted people to be individual, free human beings. And that doesn't sound to me like a reactionary agenda.
Would it be fair to say he's not a natural novelist? I think at some points he himself suggested he wasn't a natural novelist, but novels were one possible vehicle for the abstract ideas that fascinated him, and also thinking about those abstract ideas as they were played out in reality. But in fact, he wasn't particularly interested in storytelling or character.
Well, I think that's very true. And because he had an extraordinary honesty about himself, he said so. He said that basically he felt that he was an essayist, a man of ideas, and the novel was a form that he used, but he used it as a vehicle for ideas, and he was probably just as happy writing essays, of which he was had a great gift for writing light but serious essays. Yes, he was more of a thinker than an imaginative novelist. And you can illustrate this quite well, I think, by comparing Brave New World to 1984 as a work of fiction is a much richer, more deeply imagined, more disturbing piece of imaginative creation than Brave New World, which is a bit of a giggle, really. So I don't think the art of the novel possessed him quite as much as it would by some of his contemporaries.
Brave New World is a sort of thought experiment, whereas 1984 is more of a nightmare, and I guess that has a greater power to, yes, to attract and fascinate and horrify.
Yes, and there was a famous exchange of letters between Huxley and Orwell. Orwell sent Huxley his novel, and Huxley, old Etonian that he was, always immaculately polite, said, "Yes, thank you very much indeed, I enjoyed your novel very much." But he said, "I thought mine was better prophecy." Now, when he said that, that might have surprised people. But I think from our perspective now, I think he was probably right, because he was predicting the kind of soft power that we are experiencing now, the way in which the digital oligarchs like Apple and Microsoft are controlling our lives, the revelations of Edward Snowden and so forth, the quiet, unseen manipulations of the system with which we seem, curiously, to collude so willingly. That's Brave New World, rather than Orwell's The Jackboot on the Face. And we know perfectly well that there are plenty of parts of the world at the moment, like Syria, where the jackboot is still very active. But I think in Western consumer societies, I think Huxley's prophecy was closer to what has actually happened.
But if the opiates are still being puffed into the atmosphere, we're too happy to really take that on board.
Yes, indeed. And this idea of what he, this catchphrase he had of people loving their slavery, the way we willingly seem to forfeit our rights. And only this week, the playwright David Hare was expressing bafflement that we were not angrier than we should be when we discover what the kind of data that is being kept on us and the monitoring of the individual. Things that the Stasi and the KGB could never have dreamed of are happening in Britain and in America.
Beyond Brave New World, the other thing which Huxley is known for in the popular imagination is the mescaline experiments and the doors of perception. How big an element of his later life was that? Because it seems to sort of be a piece with the parapsychology and the mysticism and the seeking for some other kind of answers beyond the rational and the intellectual.
Yes. Like a number of other people, he was on Peter Blake's famous record sleeve of Sergeant Pepper. There he was, alongside Dylan Thomas and various other people, which might imply a suggestion that he was rather hip or cool, which I don't think he really was. If you read about this famous drug experiment that took place in his suburban home in Hollywood in the 1950s, it was done in extremely carefully monitored scientific conditions, and it really was an experiment in consciousness. And his wife, Laura Huxley, insisted when I spoke to her that he deplored the 60s drug culture, the sort of Timothy Leary whom Huxley met, the sort of Timothy Leary idea of, you know, tune in and turn on, or is it turn on and tune in, or whatever it is. But I tried to locate his drug experience as part of an exploration of mind and human consciousness. And earlier in his career, a book much less known than the Doors of Perception, called The Perennial Philosophy, which was a kind of an anthology of writings about, for want of a better shorthand term, mysticism, the transcendental. And this had preoccupied Huxley all his life. Puzzlingly, you might think, because of this cerebral egghead, the supreme rational grandson of Thomas Henry Huxley, what was he doing getting interested in transcendental religion and mysticism? And the fact is, his voracious mind wanted to explore everything. Now, I feel that the record of his drug experiments is in some sense a disappointment. He wanted to perceive the kind of visions that William Blake would get by just having a cup of mint tea. You know, he just didn't have the kind of mind that could have visions. He said himself he's a poor visualizer, although he did paint, actually. And one of the great mysteries of Huxley is where all these paintings went, because I challenged his son on this. I said, where are they? And he said, oh, yes, we used to have some. Apparently, he wasn't a bad painter.
Which is perhaps extraordinary for someone almost blind in one eye for large portions of his life.
Kenneth Clark, the great art critic, wrote a piece about this, saying that Huxley was a very acute art critic, and I think he described going to a gallery with him, and he was juggling with his lenses, you know, trying to look at the paintings. So, with all the however many doses of mescaline or LSD he administered to himself, he didn't really achieve what he wanted to achieve. And I think that's it makes The Doors of Perception a rather sad book in many ways. It's a cult book because it's about drugs, and drugs are endlessly glamorized. But actually, if you read it hard-headedly, it's a bit of a disappointment, I think.
Now, Brave New World appears and probably will continue to appear on the list of the great 100 best novels of the 20th century. Where would you direct someone who has perhaps read that but not encountered any of Huxley's other writings?
Well, I would recommend his very first novel called Chrome Yellow. The first two or three novels were satirical, they were funny, they were very, very clever and sharp. And as the 20s progressed, his novels became longer, denser. And I rather suspect that, for example, Point Counterpoint isn't read very much now, whereas Chrome Yellow has a kind of zest and vitality and brevity that I think I would say was a good starting point. Other books, his essays of the 20s and 30s have actually worn reasonably well. You know, for example, an essay that called The Olive Tree, where he writes about what the olive tree means to European civilization, is a wonderful example of his gift for taking up serious subjects but treating them very lightly and entertainingly.
And Eyeless and Gaza, because I think in the book you suggest that's perhaps his greatest novel?
If you're going to try and evaluate him as a novelist, then in spite of what might seem to contradict what I've just said, but I think Eyeless and Gaza and Point Counterpoint are probably his most ambitious achievements.
That was Nicholas Murray in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Nicholas on his website at www.nicholasmurray.co.uk. And that concludes episode 78, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 79, the journalist, non-fiction writer and novelist Marcel Bernstein speaks with Carol Angier about the golden era of newspaper interviewing, her early career in journalism, and her first book, Nuns. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.